Welcome into another edition of the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Have a very intriguing show for you folks here this evening, afternoon, morning, whenever you're listening. I'll tell you, you know, the darndest things happen when you put a call out to people. We do a Parashare segment here, as you know, on Wednesdays. Yesterday we had a Parashare segment on Supernatural News. A lot of times we'll put out a call for a producer. A producer will come to us and say, you know, we're looking for stories as well. I was on a show called Paranormal Night Shift on Travel Channel, where we took your stories from the workplace and different paranormal experiences you had while at work. And we turned those into stories for a show that ended up airing on the Travel Channel. A lot of times you'll submit your stories and they'll go to a producer that will be made into different programs anywhere. Hotel Paranormal, I believe, took some of those stories. Interestingly enough, our guests today have an interesting story that I want to start out with at the top of the show that has to do with the subject of our story today and where we're going today. Our guests are two distinguished guests that I'm happy to have with us today. And we're going to be talking about their book, The Paranormal Pendulum 3, The Abduction of Lindsay Higgins, who is our subject today. UFO abduction is where we're going today, but a little bit deeper than just UFO abduction. We're going to be talking about other subjects that actually tie into UFO abduction and much, much more. It's just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, and in ways that I didn't think that UFO abduction would tie into these subjects. And I know I'm kind of going in circles here, but you'll see where I'm going as we continue down the rabbit hole, because it is quite fascinating. It's one of those things that I don't know how it ties in, but bear with me. We'll get there as we circle the drain, so to speak. Dan Baldwin and George Sewell are our guests today. Dan Baldwin is a professional writer, often a ghostwriter for other professionals. He has written and co-written or ghosted more than 50 books and has won numerous local, regional, and national awards. He's a certified clinical hypnotherapist, plays the Native American flute, and is an expert pendulum dowser, having used the pendulum to assist in finding missing persons for over 15 years. And George Sewell is with us. He describes himself as a cognitive philanthropist, active in all aspects of theater. His undergraduate degree is speech and journalism from Northwestern State University in Louisiana, and a master's of arts degree in drama and communications from the University of New Orleans. As a playwright, he has written plays for community theater, college theater, and dinner theater. He was awarded the Louisiana Division of Arts Fellowship in Theater and Playwriting. Vocationally, he is retired as a counselor, MA Counseling, Louisiana Tech, and Licensed Prevention Professional. He's a program manager and administrator in the field of addictive disorders, including problem gambling. He's an author of Habits, Patterns, and Thoughts That Go Bump in the Night, A Gnome, A Candle, and Me. Just the Facts, Please, are frequently asked questions about alcohol and drug abuse. His co-author, of course, is Dan Baldwin on that. And the novel, The Chrismere. More mischief can be found at his website, Thoughts That Go Bump in the Night, at www.georgesewell.com. He resides in Louisiana. Let's welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show both Dan Baldwin and George Sewell. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so let's let the cat out of the bag here at the beginning of the program. We're talking about Lindsay Sewell today to start with, and Lindsay was the subject of Haunted on Netflix in the first season, and her UFO abduction story. Now, interestingly enough, as we got together before we started recording here today, George, you told me what? You told me that Lindsay actually did what in order to appear on Haunted on Netflix?
Well, how this whole project begins in the book Paranormal Pendulum 3, I mean, it's the story of this whole project. Mm-hmm. Quick little background on Lindsay. She's a Shreveport, Louisiana woman who all her life has been experiencing any number of paranormal and extraterrestrial experiences. And like so many people who've had decades of such experiences, it's difficult to find some outlet to converse with, to talk to somebody about, to discuss it, describe it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And Lindsay pretty much had to sit on everything for many, many decades, just a few close friends that she could have some discussion.
Sure.
But she reached a point to where I can't sit on this anymore. It's tearing me up. I've got to get this out. And she wasn't sure how to do that. And that's when she happened to tune in to Darkness Radio one evening. And of all things, you were promoting a Los Angeles-based production company that was seeking true stories of lifelong paranormal events. And that fit Lindsay to a T. And so her little light went off and said, okay, that's the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to write up my story, send it to them, and it's out there. Okay, fine. I don't have to squash this anymore. Well, she did. She sent it out. And I think it was 14 hours later, she gets a call back from the producers wanting to set up a formal Skype interview with the creative team. Mm-hmm. That's accomplished. And so a little bit more than 24 hours after she hit the send button on her computer, she's going to be a part of that series. And it moves from there. And in November of 2017, she's on location out near Pasadena, California. I happen to be there as well. And she appears in the first season of Netflix Haunted, and it's episode 5. And it gives a pretty good feeling of what Lindsay was experiencing for much of her life. And it has your a fabulous money shot of an actual abduction that occurred when she was a college sophomore. But it all began because she just happened to tune into Darkness Radio.
That's amazing. You know, Dan, here's my fear, though, and I want to address this with you. It's one thing to listen to a radio show or listen to a podcast and hear that a Hollywood producer wants to get your story. It's another to get it right. It's another to put your faith into somebody to tell your story and to tell it accurately, but then put your trust in someone to not camp it up or to not take it seriously. What kind of a person is Lindsay that she had that kind of faith or trust to empty her soul to this producer and then be sure that they got it right?
Well, the one word that comes to mind is gutsy. She just, you know, once she had the conviction in her heart that this is the right thing to do, she just stepped right forward and hasn't slowed down since. Wow. So she is out there now, taking everything that comes her way, but telling people that, this is what happened to me. This is real. There are a lot of people like you, like me out there. This is happening to you. It's real. It's nothing for you to be ashamed about. It's nothing for you to hide. It's okay for you to find, reasonable people to discuss this with. Tell your story. Get it out there. There are more of us out there than you think. Mm. You're not alone.
Yeah, the way it worked with Lindsay, Tim, is part of the discussion she had with the production company. They were asking, do you know of any other people in the Shreveport, Bossier City area, this is northwest Louisiana, who've had similar type experiences or know about these types of experiences? So she called up the late Joe Beth Baggett, one of her mutual friends who knew me and mm-hmm. knew that I had a background with the Mutual UFO Network and such. And she told Lindsay, well, give George a call. You can talk to him. Mm-hmm. And so one night out of the blue, the phone rang and I picked it up and, hello, is this George Sewell? Yeah, this is Lindsay Higgins. Joe Beth said that I could call you and, well, we could talk about some things. And for 2 hours, Lindsay pretty much gave me her story, beginning with an incredible event that occurred when she was 2.5, 3 years old up to the present. So what I was able to do for Lindsay at the end of that call was pretty much say to her, Lindsay, everything you have described to me, I've heard from other people through the years, and virtually every event that she described, I had spoken with someone usually back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was assistant state director in Louisiana for a Mutual UFO Network, had a chance to talk to a lot of people, and mostly they were just wanting to have a confidential ear. They really weren't investigating and find out what's going on. They just wanted to have somebody to tell, to listen to, and to give some feedback. So in those accounts, and at that time, Dan was living in Shreveport, and often we would both go and do the interviews and compare notes and whatnot. But it was just uncanny how very similar Lindsay's stories were to these other people. And that was very reassuring for her.
Reassuring for her that she had had similar experiences. But for you, is it, what's a good way to put this, George? Is it reassuring for you that similar stories confirm that she's had a genuine experience, or reassuring that she's not trying to put one over on you, or reassuring that maybe she hasn't just read other experiences and isn't trying to ape those experiences and trying to put one over on you? I guess as an investigator and a MUFON trained one at that, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? How do you try to weed out that story and make sure that Lindsay's had a genuine experience?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm not an investigator per se. I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm wearing more of my counselor hat.
Okay, sure, sure.
So that I'm a confidential ear for people who just want to talk, get it out, and get some form of legitimate feedback. Mm-hmm. What I look for is stories that have commonalities. That's what gets my attention, because stories can be separated in time and location and all sorts of age ranges, races. I mean, it runs the gamut, but there's almost always some commonality that kind of speaks to there's something genuine about this. Now, granted, you're going to have the personal interpretations, the personal awarenesses will vary, but the event, the occurring factor, is enough consistency to it that, okay, I will give this some validity. And there's a whole lot of that with Lindsay's stories.
So let me drop in something real quick here.
Sure.
Also, in relation to Lindsay's story specifically, we also had the backup of decades of medical reports. Lindsay, throughout her life, has had all kinds of anomalous medical flare-ups, different medical issues. And this is typical, again, like George said, of the abduction experience, but she would go to the doctors and they could find no medical reason for the problem she was having. So she's had a lifetime of these mysterious events, and that, combined with the similar experiences with, thousands of other abductees, that reinforces the fact that, yeah, she's legitimate.
Yeah, and even when she was a young child, she would experience really, as she describes, very severe abdominal pains, even at the age of 9, 10, and so on. And that's when she was admitted to the hospital for several days, and they just ran the gamut of any test possible to find some diagnosis to explain the pain, and there was none. They could find no diagnosis that would account for what she was experiencing. The best they could come up with is her mother was dying of cancer at the time, and well, they said, well, she's just doing this just to get attention. And, of course, that was nonsense.
Besides the abdominal pains, what other types of weird medical anomalies was she going through?
Well, that's in the book.
Oh, okay. Okay.
She also had, the typical different marks, puncture marks and painted type marks on her body, different parts of the body after the experiences.
Okay. Okay. Was there any abuse allegations at the time leveled against her parents?
No.
No?
No, not at all.
No.
Okay. Because, at times, especially with younger children, you would think that someone would see these marks, especially like at a school or someone.
The marking and stuff, that was probably later in her life.
Okay.
The main thing she was concerned with as a child was just these intense pains and her ability to see shadow people. Other figures around the house on the property where she grew up in that she would try to explain to her father that, hey, I saw these two things out there. And he'd go, look, I don't see nothing. What are you talking about? So that was part of that picture, too, as part of the confusion and stress on her as a child. But as far as any physicality stuff, no, there was none of that.
Let's start more towards the beginning of Lindsay's first memories of when she had an experience. What is Lindsay's first real recollection of seeing something unusual?
Okay, Tim, you walked right into it. Lindsay has an actual memory of when she was approximately 2.5 to 3 years old let me back up just a bit. At this time, her family's a restaurant family, the Petita family in Shreveport, Bossier, very well known, very well respected.
Okay.
At that time, this would have been the late 1970s, her father, who has a great interest in railroads all his life, he bought a railroad station called Central Station in downtown Shreveport and converted it into a restaurant. And the family operated the restaurant downstairs. And while the restaurant's busy, young Lindsay is upstairs in her room. And one day, it's a nice, bright, sunny day, and Lindsay's in her room, and she's a little bored and thinks it'd be fun to go outside and play. Now, there's a great big balcony that wraps around the first and second floor of the building. There's a picture of it in the book. And some people outside approaching the restaurant suddenly noticed this little toddler out running around on the balcony. So they went inside the restaurant and say, who's this kid running around on the balcony? And of course, Joe and his wife run upstairs and pull Lindsay back into the room. Joe closes the very, very heavy double hung window. Dan and I have seen this window, and there's no way a 2.5-3 year old child is going to budge that window. But the window was opened. She went outside. She's brought back inside. The window's closed. Lindsay, how did that window get open? Oh, my friend Morlock opened it for me so I could go out and play. And that began a detective story about who is Lindsay's spirit playmate that is able to manipulate physical objects such as a very heavy double-hung window. Yeah. And you want to pick up the adventure there, Dan?
Well, yeah, that's where the reincarnation aspect of Lindsay's stories comes in. I was doing research, and George is helping me significantly do research for my book, The Paranormal Pendulum 2, which is really a collection of what it's like in the spirit world on the other side, what the transition is like, what it's like there. And halfway through that, you know, George introduced me to Lindsay, and we started investigating her case, and that bumped right into a case of a pure reincarnation. Lindsay, her dad, and her sister are the immediate reincarnation of a family that lived in the Shreveport area back in the late 19th century. So we were led on basically a detective story. George framed it right. We were scheduled to go to a prominent cemetery, an old cemetery in Shreveport, in the afternoon. So one morning we decided, since we had some free time, let's see if we can call up somebody, see if a spirit will answer us. So we contacted a spirit, just a regular guy, and asked if he was buried in the cemetery. He said, yes. So we said, we're going to go there this afternoon. Would you show up? We'd love to see your gravesite. He said, yes. So that afternoon we go to the cemetery, meet the spirit. He leads us across the cemetery to a gravesite. It's not his gravesite. And basically we were handed off from one spirit to the next, a guy by the name of Pinnock. He led us on not a wild goose chase, but on a trek through the entire cemetery using the pendulum dowsing techniques, and led us to a rather prominent gravesite at the top of the hill of the Woodruff family. And we discovered through a lot of research, primarily pendulum dowsing research at that point, that Morlock was a guy by the name of W.D. Woodworth, who lived in the Shreveport area in, like I said, the late 1800s. His daughter, Sally Murph Woodruff, is the spirit who became Lindsay Higgins now. So it's a real reincarnation. You know, we've got the UFOs, but now we're bumping into reincarnation.
Yeah. And we're getting, and there's more to that Morlock story that kind of surprised us, because Dan and I were both convinced it was the W.D. Woodworth that he was, because he said he was, that he was the Morlock. Lindsay's father, Joe, just wasn't having that. Back when the event took place, when Lindsay described Morlock, she gave description of a kind of a silver haired man, kind of lean. She didn't know what a cigar was, but she knew that her parents smoked cigarettes. So she said, well, he smokes something like you do, but it's big and brown. And that got Joe's attention, because frequently you could go around the building and you would smell cigar smoke, and nobody smoking cigars. Mm-hmm. Even to this day, that occurs. So Joe, we were at a session at the Central Station discussing Morlock and W.D. Woodworth. And Joe was asking about a man that Pete had, Pete Couch. He was the president of one of the railroads, had his office at Central Station. And as a child, Joe Fertitta would sneak away from his neighborhood and come down and just watch all the trains. And he just loved the trains and train station. And as a child, he was acquainted with Mr. Couch. And Joe just had an idea that if there was a Morlock, it was probably going to be Pete Couch, because he loved the train station. He would be very comfortable there, whereas this WD fellow really didn't have that much of a train connection. And they went around and around and around, and finally it turned out that WD asked the spirit of Pete if he would kind of keep an eye on young Lindsay. And so that was kind of the way that turned out. What was interesting was that her father, way back when, had a suspicion that I think this might have been the spirit of Pete Couch. Now, Joe is not really big into all of this type of material, but he looks at the evidence. I mean, the window was raised. I mean, it was raised. Okay. Nobody upstairs could have done that.
Yeah.
And just that's just the way it proceeded. So there's so many twists and turns in this little mystery, and we talk about it in the first part of the book.
Well, now, George, and Dan, feel free to chime in here as well. You know, we hear about spirit energy being able to move things, but something as heavy as a double-hung window, that puts it in a different class of spirit to be able to move something that large. So, you know, when Dan was talking about, and this is where I guess I get a little confused, when Dan is talking about reincarnation and spirits reincarnating, Dan, are you insinuating that we reincarnate back and forth between an alien spirit and a human spirit?
I'm not insinuating anything. What George and I are in this book, we're just reporters. We're reporting what the spirits tell us. And there are a million questions we haven't asked simply because we're following the Lindsay Higgins story.
Yeah, definitely
reincarnation is a big part of her story.
Yeah. And we were deliberately led to the W.D. Woodworth family plot because they're very much involved, because that was the family mm-hmm. that was previously occupied by Lindsay, her father, and Lindsay's sister.
Okay.
So we had to meet that family. And I think this little detective story was our way to do that. Now, there was an interesting session, pendulum session, mm-hmm. that when Dan was in town, we had with Lindsay. And we were using the pendulum to answer some of Lindsay's questions about her previous life as Sally Woodruff.
Okay.
And at the same time, we were also communicating with the spirit of Sally Murph Woodworth as we're communicating with Lindsay. So we're talking to the same spirit in two different expressions simultaneously. And that was kind of a head scratcher. I mean, of course, it's theoretically possible, but here we are actually involved in it. And that made it visceral. So it really punched up that this is reality. And this is very likely what is occurring, certainly in Lindsay's life and with her father and her sister.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, you're thinking Morlock really is just either a spirit or a spirit from a past life that really is a companion.
What we were left with was the Morlock, and Lindsay named the spirit that. Okay, which we don't know
sure.
why she did. She doesn't know why. She just called him the Morlock from the get-go. But he was a spirit that agreed to watch over young Lindsay while she was in the old train station. He was a friend of the family, so to speak. But that was his role. It had no reincarnative attachment to the rest of Lindsay's story. It was just that particular moment where he raised the window and, well, the spirits entered.
Very interesting.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, it sounds, as you're hinting, it sounds rather incredible that a spirit could lift a double-hung door.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the double-hung door was lifted. And a two-year-old toddler, it's impossible for her to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that I mean,
yeah, the only conclusion is the spirit lifted the door.
Yeah, and there were a few other instances in this whole investigation that we had little demonstrations of what they can manipulate on that side, so to speak. There was a session Dan and I were conducting at the Spring Street Museum in Shreveport. That's kind of the city museum. Beautiful, beautiful old building, very nicely managed. And we were upstairs in a 19th century parlor type format. And we were conducting a pendulum conversation with one of the brothers who built this building. And that brother was acquainted with the W.D. Woodward family. And at that time, Dan and I were suspicious that maybe Lindsay, in her previous incarnation, was W.D. Woodward's wife. And we were asking the gentleman at the building for descriptions of his wife. You know, how was she tall? Was she short? Brown hair? Light colored hair? Did she play the piano? Did she like music? Just some things that we could present to Lindsay to see if any of it rang a bell, so to speak. So after that session, Dan and I are back at the house that evening playing that record. We always record everything. And we were playing back that recording. And we're getting, I'm answering a question, and Dan's getting a yes or no response. And just got that's going on. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Lindsay is key. A very firm male voice, an EVP, but no two ways about it. Lindsay is key. And we've replayed that a half dozen times at least because it was just, whoa. We've heard EVPs before, but never anything that strong and that deliberate and with a very precise message. Lindsay is key. And so, whoa, hello. Okay, we got it. We got it. Then a month or so later, Dan's back in Arizona and he's beginning to make the transcript from that session. And as he's playing back the tape, there's no EVP. Really? It's not there. So later that year, we had a session and we were communicating with W.D. Woodworth. He's a likable character, but he's a character. And he confessed that, yes, he was the author of the EVP. And yes, he removed it.
Really? No, why would
That sounds crazy, but George and I, when we first heard it, we played it back, like you said, a half a dozen times. We know it was there because we over and over. It was so startling. Mm-hmm. You know, play that again. When I got back to Arizona, it was gone.
Why would he go about removing an EVP from you? Why would
a demonstration?
Just to prove what he could give you, he could take away?
We were given a lot of information from other sources in our investigation, just to kind of demonstrate the range of activity that these people have in their current existence. And I think this is just a way of letting us know that they can manipulate electronics or whatever forces are involved with recordings to put something in and take it out if they want.
Well, yeah, on top of that, you know, WD was a rascal. It's the kind of stunt he would pull. You know, just because, you know, he became something almost a buddy while we were in Shreveport. But he's a rascal. That's the kind of stunt he would do and just, you know, get off on laughing. Well, I showed him. It's much in character.
Yeah.
We did get other EVPs, though, from the sessions, but that was the most dramatic.
Mm-hmm. And the other ones stuck. The other ones weren't removed.
Yeah, we had one, George, talking about it. The museum upstairs is like a parlor. So we had one of the museum staff with us, and she was going on and on and on. And she said something about, you know, you people really, you know, you had a lot of class and you really did beautiful work here with your house. Right after that, there's a clear female voice going, "Why, thank you." Clear as a bell from someone who wasn't there physically.
It's a nice catch. It's a nice catch indeed.
Yeah, no, I need to point out to you, we don't go out trying to collect EVPs. They come along because we're recording the session because we want it accurate for the book.
Right.
And when we get an EVP, you know, thank God, it's, you know, it's great. It, you know, it's a plus.
Yeah.
But you know, we're not EVP collectors.
No.
Right. Yeah.
It's a form of validation, but it's only one form.
Right.
Yeah, and this is also time to be sure that your listeners are. Yeah, we're not Dan and I aren't using the paranormal pendulum for entertainment purposes or whatnot. It was an investigative tool for this particular case to find out what's going on with Lindsey Higgins. We also had two mediums involved with us on the team. Very often they would corroborate and or have very similar impressions of what we were getting from the pendulum. So there's a lot of checking of the information over this 2-year period. It took about 2 years to put it all together. So there was a great deal of confidence in much of the story. And we stayed focused on Lindsey as best we could. I mean, this thing could have gone off in 300-400 different directions, but we were going to, this is Lindsey's story. We're going to tell Lindsey's story. And yeah, it's getting a little wacky here, but it's being confirmed. So, okay, we're going to bring that in because it's part of Lindsey's story.
How is Lindsey feeling as you're collecting this evidence and you're finding out about these past life pieces and you're communicating with these spirits? Is she uneasy about it? Is she feeling all right about it? Or are things resonating? And as they're resonating, is she feeling more familiar? Is she feeling estranged? What's
she's seeing the reasons for why she's been experiencing what she's been experiencing. And on the whole, is bringing her much relief and a much learning, if you will. And let me give an example here. Dan, chime in if you like. But clearly, Lindsey, most of her life has had episodes of what we call paranormal experiences or some sort of event that would be attributed to someone being psychic, if you will. Okay. And in one session, we learned that 4,000 years ago, a poverty point in Northeast Louisiana, that's a World Heritage Site, I don't know if you're familiar with, a very, very highly regarded, very ancient site, where we were in contact with a medicine man with that population, again, 4,000 years ago. He allowed us to call him Jokpo. And we learned that at the same time, Lindsey was incarnated there as a young male who had come up from Mexico or Central America specifically to be apprenticed to this medicine man. And one of the reasons for that apprenticeship is that the medicine man was the go-between, the people of Poverty Point, and the sky people who occasionally came down to interact with them. So Lindsey was there having this training, this probably very psychic training, sixth sense type training is what I'm suspicious of. And that has carried over low these 4,000 years, and she still has that trained ability, although she doesn't have quite the control over it she apparently once had.
Sky people. It's curious you put it that way, that she had training.
We didn't put it that way. The Native Americans put it that way.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
That's an avenue we are currently exploring right now.
Yeah.
It's interesting that that's the way it was put, sky people. Yeah.
Oh, that's the way they described it.
Right, right. I'm just thinking back to language in different ancient texts and when they refer to things in the sky. Mm-hmm. He didn't say gods. They didn't say that they were communicating with gods or deities. They said sky people.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful point. Well, last week I was up in Utah visiting various cliff dwellings, way, way, way back in the wilderness, but beautiful ruins. And using the pendulum dowsing techniques, I was making contact with the Native American spirits who lived there at that time. And I started asking about the sky people. That's really one of the main purposes of my trek back in there. But I was asking about the sky people. Were your people visited by people from the sky, what we call sky people? I would get a yes. Did you interact with the sky people? I got yes. Ask them, were they considered gods? I got a no. Were they considered emissaries from the gods? I got a no. Were they considered basically people? Got a solid yes. The people, again, George and I are just reporters, but the people, the spirits we've discussed with so far are that the sky people came down, that they were basically Homo sapiens, or at least looked like Homo sapiens, and they interacted on a person-to-person level.
So there's a very clear delineation between, we know the difference between our deities and what sky people are.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Very interesting indeed.
But they were, I mean, and that has been repeated. I've been up there a number of times, and I'm going to go back every chance I get. But consistently, it was, are they gods? No. Are they people? Yes.
Hmm.
And I asked about trade. You know, I said, was there trade going on? And I got a definite yes. And after some exploration, you know, pendulum dowsing is very, it's accurate, but it's very tedious. But in essence, they were seen to be trading ideas. It's a trade on an intellectual level.
You know, I think we tend to project what we think is being written in ancient texts, and we tend to think that our ancestors didn't know the difference, Dan.
Right.
That they were confused, that they think that sky people and gods were one and the same. And
that's our limitation.
Yeah, that's our interpretation, exactly.
It's like if you look at the petroglyphs on the walls, our walls up here are covered with rock art. Mm-hmm. And you'll see very descriptive artwork of turtles and trees and people and deer and elk and lizards. And then you see crazy squiggly lines.
Mm-hmm.
So people looking at that say, well, they're accurate when they're drawing the turtles and the bears and the lions and the tigers. But the squiggly lines, they didn't see that. You know, that those crazy designs, those are just doodles. They're you know, Indian doodles is what they are. But yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me that they would draw half of what they see very accurately, and then the other half would be doodles.
Right.
And so on this last trip, I'm leading to a point. The last trip, I asked him, I said, did the artist who drew those crazy drawings up there draw what they saw? And I got a firm yes.
Interesting indeed. Yeah, I would think they'd be very literal when they were drawing, because they were trying to communicate. They were trying
exactly.
to let future generations know this is what we saw at the time that we saw it.
And yeah, we were here and this is what we saw. And
yeah. Yeah. And because they, you know, it's not like they could take a photograph. They were drawing out what they were drawing and, and saying, you know, beware, this is what is here, or this is a snapshot of what we had at our time. You know, this is what you have to look forward to.
Yeah, I think that's the most likely.
Right, right. At this point, let's take our break. When we come back, let's get a little bit further into Lindsay's story and figure out when it is that she combines her past life experience with eventual sky people or UFOs, and how her past life combines with UFO aliens and the sky people. And I think I'm teasing a little bit because we're starting to put the pieces together a little bit here. Again, the name of the book is The Paranormal Pendulum 3, The Abduction of Lindsay Higgins. There's a big, long title there. You guys told me it before the beginning of the show, but my memorization skills are gone. Does one of you want to say the entire name of the book?
I've got it here. I don't have it memorized either. I have to look at my notes. But
okay.
Paranormal Pendulum 3, The Abduction of Lindsay Higgins, The UFO Phenomenon, The Spirit World, and Beyond.
There you go. That's good, Dan. You got it down. We've got a link to it in the description of the show. It is available at Where All Good Booksellers Are, or even online at Where All Good Booksellers Are Online, but we've got a link in the description of the show. You can click on it and pick up your copy today. When we come back, Lindsay Higgins, how aliens enter into her life, and what does it have to do, the connection with her past lives? We'll tackle that when we get back. Again, our guests are Dan Baldwin and George Sewell, the co-authors of The Paranormal Pendulum 3. When we come back, that connection between aliens and her past lives. When we come back here on The Best in Paranormal Podcasting here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guests are Dan Baldwin and George Sewell, the co-authors of The Paranormal Pendulum 3, The Abduction of Lindsay Higgins. When we last left you, we were talking about not just the past lives of Lindsay Higgins, but we were setting up for you the potential of the connection between sky people, or aliens as we know them, and what it has to do with the spirit world. We've been talking a little bit about Lindsey Higgins' past lives and the reason that George and Dan were brought into Lindsey Higgins' life initially. And we want to get into a little bit now what those crazy marks on Lindsey's body were all about. And when she started having what she remembers as, let's just say, meetings with sky people or aliens from above. I'm just going to call them sky people.
Okay. This is a good example of the benefit of pendulum dowsing as an investigative tool.
Okay.
During the course of these 2 years, on many, many occasions, Dan and I were using the pendulum and having conversations with, for lack of a better term, an extraterrestrial who was head of the group that was working with Lindsey. Just for our convenience sake, he said we could refer to him as ET. So we were conversing with the aliens themselves about Lindsey's case and what's going on, why is it going on? And so we had this kind of information gave a continuity to Lindsey's experiences that I don't think anybody was expecting. It turns out that what's been happening with Lindsey in this lifetime was a carryover from a previous lifetime and a previous lifetime and it went back to, as best we could determine, 6,000 years ago. Lindsey in spirit and this ET as spirit, a very highly evolved spirit. We can come back to that with our two mediums in a minute. But Lindsey was asked if she would participate in a longitudinal, long-term process that would benefit Homo sapiens and some other species. And part of the reason she was asked to do this, because she was an Earth person and would be reincarnating during this period. And apparently the ability to reincarnate was a factor that needed to be in place for whatever was occurring to become real or tangible. I'm presuming this may be something with carryover DNA or something. We didn't get into that kind of detail. Mm-hmm. But the longevity of it is what struck Lindsey. He said, whoa, I agreed to do this. And as Lindsey would say, well, if I agreed to do it, then I will do it. And this is something that's in the literature all over the place. A lot of, well, you agreed to this. Don't you remember? No, hell no. Lindsey, that was actually kind of a reassurance. Okay, so this hasn't been something out of the blue where I'm just being snatched and tormented. These visitations, is what we ended up calling them, they have a purpose. It may be a physical purpose. It may have some sort of genetic or other component. It may be a working with psychic abilities. So some of these experiences that Lindsey had with ETs and were physical, actual physical, like the one depicted in the Netflix episode where she's literally pulled out of her bedroom through a wall into a craft and off to another realm for some specific work. But a lot of it is also in the astral sense, where they're just working with her consciousness or her spirit.
Yep.
So it covers the gamut, but it has been going on for a long time. Now, with Lindsey's awareness, okay, well, if I'm going to continue this, this pain that's associated with it, it's got to stop.
Right.
And it turned out some of the ETs were not really aware that she was having that much discomfort. And they said, well, of course, yeah, we can take measures so that this will not happen again. So Lindsey made that specific request. And she reports that since that time, there have been some visitations, but there was no discomfort associated with the visitation. So apparently that's holding. And that was, of course, a great relief for all.
You know, I'm curious, George, I want to stop you for a second. How is it that these creatures can't know that we're feeling pain when we're going through some of these, for lack of a better term, experimentations? How do they not know that we're not going through the same, you know, this excruciating pain? Do they not have the same nervous system, or do they not have the same nerve endings that they don't know that we're feeling these excruciating pain, you know, we had these pain receptors that, you know, basically we feel like we're being bored out when they're doing these experiments to us?
Well, that was not pursued as a specific line of questioning because we weren't interested so much in the ETs as we were with Lindsay's experience.
Okay.
But we did get some feedback that there were some, not all, but some of the ETs who were involved in this team, and apparently it's been a consistent team through the centuries, just were not aware of the physical sensation of that she was having intense pain because of this. They know better now. But that would be a whole different investigation into the physical interactions of the extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, I've always wondered that, you know, it just seems like such a, there's two things that always have hit me when it comes to the extraterrestrial phenomena. It's this, especially it's consideration. One, it just seems like permission is assumed. I get the, you know, you made this contract a long time ago, maybe even in a past life in Lindsay's case. So when it comes to that, they just assume permission is granted. So we're going to come in and do it, even though Lindsay has no memory of it. So it's just the audacity of showing up and, you know, here we go, whether she's ready or not.
I would say it's the appearance of audacity.
Yes, the appearance of audacity.
That's our interpretation. That may not be, in fact, what's occurring, but with even the word abduction has a very negative intent. I mean, a crime is being committed. So just using the language, we're setting up a very negative adverse situation. And that's been so reinforced all these decades that we were a little surprised, frankly, to look at what would be a larger perspective, a bigger picture of this particular case. And you really can't look at it in that light.
Do you have a better word for it?
We call visitations.
Visitation. Okay. So,
I need to toss in something else to consider here. In terms, you mentioned the pain. If you're from a culture or a race or a dimension that doesn't understand pleasure or pain, you might not be able, I'm speculating here, but you might not be able to tell the difference between the two. I mean, this person is screaming on your table. You may not realize that represents pain.
True.
Again, that's speculation, but if they don't know it, they need to be told, hey, this is not the right thing to do. And that's what happens in Lindsay's case.
And a little bit of support from that, from Jacopo at Poverty Point, and one session with him, we did glean that there was information that the Sky people were presenting to him that he could put to use down in Poverty Point. And in return, he was assisting them in understanding human emotions and feelings.
Okay.
So we're not, again, that's as far as we've gone with that. We'll pick up more information in the current investigation. But that does seem to be part of the case, that the human beings are kind of alien.
Well, I guess maybe I am looking at it from a human being perspective, but I guess...
Well, what other perspective?
Right. Yeah. But I guess it's the... I guess to finish my point, it's the assumption of permission. Then it's the non-caring, non-feeling, just kind of going into the procedure without care for the patient. Put it that way. If it were a doctor-patient relationship, the doctor being the extraterrestrial would just be boring into the patient and not caring for them without anesthesia or anything with that. And then look at aftercare. If you want to look at it from a doctor-patient relationship, okay, there's not a lot of aftercare here. It just kind of seems like experiments are done and they go away, and you don't ever hear about aftercare of a patient. So if Lindsay were a patient, let's put it this way, if we're looking at it from a doctor-patient relationship, what exactly, if she entered into a contract with these extraterrestrials, then what is it that they're doing to benefit her? What is her benefit in this whole deal?
I would guess, I don't know what her contract is, but I would guess enhanced awareness, enhanced consciousness, the ability to finally she's been able to put herself in a position where she can help a lot of other people in trouble. Her benefit will be to be a guiding light to help people through what she's gone through.
That's certainly been the case, certainly since she listened to your program in September of 2017. But we got a little glimpse at maybe what the anticipated result of this long-term project would be. And apparently things are changing on planet Earth with human beings, and we're going to see basically human beings living about twice as long as they currently do. That say 150 years would be an average lifespan for a human being. And that in itself, over 50, 60 years, a century even, that'll dramatically change the planet. Coupled with that is a real, and I say reawakening, of the psychic ability, the sixth sense that our ancestors had. I think they had very easy relationships with the dearly departed, extraterrestrials, other sentient beings on little higher frequencies that for whatever reason has been lost or suppressed, but that is going to be greatly enhanced. So the life experience for a human being is just going to be just something spectacular compared to what we are currently doing. So that seems to be what Lindsay's working for. Okay. In the long run for the benefit of her fellow humans. And obviously other species may benefit from whatever it is they're doing as well.
I could go negative Nancy here on you, George, and say, well, what's the great deal about living to 150 years when we're sapping our resources and not exactly in touch with the planet right now?
That's because we don't have the sixth sense, and we don't have the sixth sense active as it has been in the past. And imagine if we had Nikola Tesla.
True.
For 70, 80 more years.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a lot of ways to look at it. That's just the information we gleaned. And I can see how that would have a profound effect over a bit of time,
right,
with human beings and planet Earth.
Right. Very true. Very true.
That's the interest in the psychic phenomenon has just burst wide open in the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, your program is one pure example. Mm-hmm. Of that. You know, people are more and more interested in it. And I do a lot of lecturing and speaking, but I'm finding more and more people vastly more open to it than they've ever been before.
Absolutely. So
there is very possible that there is a psychic awakening going on.
I would hope so.
One thing I've discovered, people have all kinds of mystical ideas about, contacting the deceased. You know, you've got to go through all these rituals, and you've got to have a seance, and you've got to have a dark room and all this kind of stuff. And one thing we've discovered, if you want to just have a conversation with a departed person, ask a departed person to show up. It's that simple. There's no ritual involved. We have a pendulum when we do it. We have a pendulum because it helps in communication. Mm-hmm. And we have a recorder because we want to record the information. But basically, we will go to a site and ask, is there a friendly spirit here who would like to have a conversation with Dan and George? And somebody shows up, and usually somebody, a spirit that is involved in whatever we're researching.
Let me ask you.
I mean, it's remarkably easy, and it's remarkably simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we found that they like to talk. Our mediums affirm that. Oh, yes, big time. They love to talk.
Well, let me ask you both, and I'll start with Dan. When you bring that up, that it's relatively easy, you don't need a dark room, you don't need a seance, you don't need to go through the pomp and circumstance. You know, science is saying now they believe that the other side really is just a quantum dimension where energy goes and shifts. It goes and shifts into this quantum pocket, and that's where it stays. Yeah. And that it could very easily transfer back and forth. Do you believe that really the other side is closer to that, or do you believe that it really is something more traditional? And I'll start with Dan, and we'll go to George.
Well, I think the quantum side is traditional. Yeah. Let me put it that way. But there definitely is another side. And I think for my research, I think there are various levels to the other side, you know, call it seven heavens or whatever you want to do. But there's a hierarchy over there where you can, you know, you land on the other side and you can continue to grow and continue to grow and continue to grow. I think, and this is just my theory, but most of the spirit activity we have here on Earth is from spirits who are still connected, who are at that first level, you know, where they're learning how, you know, you've been alive physically, now you're alive over here on this side, and you've got all these options available to you. And a lot of folks are still emotionally tied to the Earth. And those, I think, are the spirits that we most encounter.
Well, and let me follow up with you, Dan, before we go to George real quick. Why do you suppose a spirit, or other than fear of meeting that other side in judgment, why do you suppose or unfinished business, why do you suppose a spirit would want to tie itself to the Earth? Why would you not want to go see the other side?
Excellent question, and I got what I think is an excellent answer. One, there are trapped spirits here because they're afraid of basically going to hell or whatever. Mm-hmm. We have helped some of those cross over into the light. Primarily, the reason I get that the spirits are back here is, and I'm not making light, but they're on vacation.
Really?
You know, when they cross over, they're still tied to the Earth emotionally. And they still have very good memories. A lot of the spirits I've contacted tell me, I ask, you know, why are you here? About, you know, you're on the other side. Why are you back here? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, well, I'm reliving the best days of my life. Hmm. I'm having a good time. And I use the phrase, would it be fair to say you're on vacation? And I get a consistent yes with the pendulum. Wow. A perfect example, did a research from in a ranch out here, not too far from Phoenix, Arizona. Encountered a spirit. He was alive back in the 1930s, got married around, I think, 1939. He was a cowhand. They threw a big party, you know, the boss threw a party. They had the fiddles and guitars, and they were passing the jug, and they were dancing. He's married the sweetheart of, you know, his life. Mm-hmm. Happiest day of his life. Bam, Pearl Harbor. He goes over to the Pacific. He gets killed on one of the islands. So when we encountered him, over a long period of time, but we asked him, you know, he said, well, I'm back. This is the happiest day of my life.
Yeah.
And I come back here to experience that.
Hmm. I could see why.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and as time passes on, that spirit will progress. He will move up where he no longer has to come back to the Earth. But at that stage of his development, he's had happy memories back here, and he's still emotionally tied to it. He wants to experience them again. So he comes back and does it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't say that I blame him.
Yeah. George, what do you think?
Well, let's look at it from the lens of the Webb telescope, which now the universe is so much greater than ever we imagined. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no escaping that. Now, let's put into the equation the C factor, the dreaded C factor, that is consciousness. Mm-hmm. And let's add consciousness to that cosmic energy. And that really takes over an understanding or better appreciation of just how vast and varied is the universe. If you can accept, which I do, that this is consciousness, which can't be destroyed. It can do all sorts of creative things. It can open heavy double hung windows. Mm-hmm. You know, it can pull phrases out of a recording. Mm-hmm. Just all sorts of creative things that can be done in this manner of consciousness. We had a very interesting moment with E.T. When we were conducting a pendulum session down at a park in Bossier City that's adjacent to Barksdale Air Force Base. That's just the area where we were. And I was there. Dan was there. Another couple was there. David, who was also a pendulum master. So he was using the pendulum, and his wife, Lauren, who is a medium. Mm-hmm. She's got that skill set. And I asked, we'd been conversing with E.T., and I asked, E.T., is there a way you can present yourself so that perhaps Lauren can get some impressions of your true identity or your true self, your true consciousness.
Sure.
And that's where I'll point to Dan and say, take it over.
Well, we were sitting in, very comfortably under a tree, and there was in a semicircle, and Lauren and I were sitting pretty close together. And somewhere, during the program, the process, she started seeing imagery of purple, some kind of purple imagery. I couldn't see that. I don't have that skill. But she and I both felt a tremendous amount of emotion coming from a specific spot in the center of that circle. And I don't think the other three with us felt that, but she and I definitely had that feeling. And it was... the entity was literally beaming emotion at us. She called it mother love. Hmm. And if you listen to the transcript, I look over to Lauren and I said, do you feel that? She said, yeah, I feel that. And then I said to the general group, I said, Dan's tearing up here. I'm getting emotional, folks. But we felt physical love coming, beaming from this entity. It was a very strong, visceral feeling.
Hmm.
And then a session.
You can't fake that. And then that's not going to pop up spontaneously in two different people, at the same time.
Yeah. No. And I had a session with the other medium who has an active practice as an evidential medium, and specifically asked her impression of ET. And what she came back with, something along the lines of what Lauren was perceiving and what Dan caught a whiff of, was that E.T. was a very, very highly evolved soul that does not need a body. He will take on a form depending on where he's doing his work. There's so much more, and they are hard. We limit ourselves by giving them names, calling them extraterrestrials, aliens. That limits us in an awareness of their true nature, their true identity. And, okay, that's not your usual expected answer for, well, what's this ET like? But it was very similar to what Lauren was tapping into. So, I can feel comfortable with that being the nature of ET, who's been working with Lindsay and gosh knows how many other people all these thousands of years.
I have to ask you too this question. Knowing that you've now you've contacted ET through psychic means or through a metaphysical mean, I've got to ask you this. When someone has a physical contact with ET, or what seems like a physical contact with ET, do you think that we're actually having a physical experience with ET, or do you think ET is approaching us in a non-physical way, almost like a projection, like they're visiting us through a portal, like we would see a ghost? It's an apparition. It's uh-huh. Here, but it's not here. Let's start with George. We'll go to Dan.
After. Yeah, and you mentioned the portal were okay. Well, it turns out that the property that Lindsay grew up on, which has a rich history, which we do include in the book, but much of the things that Lindsay was seeing, certainly growing up, was very likely beings coming through a portal onto or near her property where her house was, or where she could see them. We did some specific pendulum work trying to establish the nature of this portal. And there was one event that really solidified it, and that was her father, Joe, was telling us that back in the early 1980s, Lindsay's maternal uncle was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at Barksdale. And there was one night that Joe recounted that he brought his young son out to the Fertitta property and pointed to a certain part of the sky and said, okay, watch there, son. And then an ET appeared, UFO, UAP, whatever you want to call it, but it appeared and then it left. So the son had the experience, and then his father said, okay, you have seen it, but you can never tell anyone about it.
Hmm.
And that kind of sounded like, we have knowledge of the portal. We know that there is some activity coming and going, and possibly some activity that even could be predicted. That was a mix with where Lindsay was growing up and was, I think, definitely a factor in her experiences. And through at that time, it turns out that she was not only seeing what we would call the aliens, the ETs, or whoever they are coming from the other dimensions, but she was also seeing the spirits of Native Americans, Caddo Indians. Dan, you want to pick that up? That's a good story.
Yeah, well, one, to answer the question, original question, I think it's all of the above.
Okay.
I think the contact is definitely physical, and the answer to your question is I think both types of contact are ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's in the book.
Yeah. As far as I discovered that this was built, constructed by, for lack of a better term, the aliens, the portal we discovered out at the place where Lindsay grew up apparently pre-existed the Earth. It has been there virtually forever. So I think contact is being made on a physical level. I also think it's made on an astral or mental level. I think it's going on at all times at both levels. Not necessarily simultaneously, but both levels are at work.
Yeah, and that makes sense because in our own experience in working with Lindsay and her father and her sister, we're having contact with physical Lindsay, and simultaneously we're having contact. So, sure, if we can have that kind of contact, physical and non-physical simultaneously, I'm pretty sure that ET can.
Okay. Real quick, before we leave people today, explain to me where the Men in Black come into this story and how Men in Black influence Lindsay's story in this book.
Yeah, that's for George.
We have a chapter in the book called The Men in Black because there were a couple of very unusual occurrences with Lindsay and also one with her husband, Tim, that kind of had the flavor of a Men in Black moment. The example would be where Lindsay works. She has her private office, and there's a direct telephone line to her desk that is never used. I mean, her husband doesn't even know what the number is. Nobody else does either. There's another line that comes in from the front office, so to speak. So if somebody's looking for Lindsay, they get connected to the front office and they route the call to her office. Well, this other line, one day, it rang. And Lindsay was kind of, whoa, that never happens. So she picked it up, hello, and then a very gruff voice said, where's Tim? Tim's not here. Can I help you? Where's Tim? And it was just a repeating of this gruff, where's Tim? I got to talk to Tim. And finally, it just hung up rather abruptly. And she's, whoa, where'd that come from? And a week or so later, her husband, Tim, is in the office with her. He brought lunch, so they're enjoying lunch in her office. And the phone goes off again. And of course, she answers, hello, I need to speak to Tim. Who's calling? I need to speak to Tim. And that just went on and clicked. And since Tim was there hearing it, he kind of, whoa, what brought that on? Mm-hmm. And there was an instance where for a couple of nights outside their home, there was a black car just kind of parked across the street for no particular reason. So we did some pendulum work on what's going on with these, and we came up with that, yes, these would be your Men in Black, so to speak, and yes, they're interested in Lindsay because her story is out, but they are not harmful. They're just keeping an eye on her, nothing malicious, and there was even a whiff of there might be a little bit of protective aspect there, so they might be keeping something else from Lindsay. So it was a little different. It was a little different, but it did happen. So it's in the book.
All right. With that, gentlemen, I think we will we'll start to wrap it up here. I know the Paranormal Pendulum 3, The Abduction of Lindsay Higgins, is out now. Again, you can get it at all good booksellers, and we have a link in the description of this show. Again, our our co-authors here, Dan Baldwin and George Sewell, are the co-authors of that book. And guys, do you have further projects you want to talk about real quick before we leave people today?
Well, the one we were discussing a little bit earlier, George and I have decided to investigate the Sky People, see what we can find out about them, their relationship, especially to the Native Americans. So that we're in the research phase right now.
Okay.
And like the previous book, there's no telling where that's going to go.
So is this the subject of a future book, or are you thinking about a different project?
Oh, you can count on that.
Oh, yeah. Paranormal Pendulum Book 4.
Okay.
Roman numeral.
Roman numeral. All right. So Paranormal Pendulum 4, we can look forward to that again. And also Paranormal Pendulum 2 is out there as well. We'll put a link up to that one as well so that people can get 2 and 3 out there. There's other books out there as well. The Practical Pendulum, Paranormal Pendulum, the Psychic Detective Guidebook, Speaking with Spirits of the Southwest, Conversations with the Spirits of the Southwest. Lots of other books out there that Dan has, George as well, Habits, Patterns, and Thoughts That Go Bump in the Night, A Turn at the Point, A Gnome, A Candle, and Me. Tell you what, we're going to put up your websites as well, gentlemen, so that people can get to know both of you and get your projects out there. Again, both of you very fascinating gentlemen, and we want people to get to know you and your projects and get to know your work. I want to thank you both for being with us today on Darkness Radio.
Pleasure.
And we want to have you back as soon as possible because we want to talk about some other projects as well.
Absolutely.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Folks, want to remind you to take care of yourself, take care of each other. Again, it's a little colder, a little harder world out there, it seems, from week to week. And we just need to make it a little brighter, a little shinier world out there and just take care of each other. Do something for one another this weekend when you're out and about. If you see somebody in need, you know, just give somebody an extra dollar, maybe help somebody out who might be in need. Maybe somebody needs a lawn mowed or something to that effect. Just take an extra minute and help your neighbor, help a friend, or maybe help a complete stranger who may need a little helping hand. Do it for your buddy Timmy. Do it for your buddies here at Darkness Radio. Do it for yourself. Make yourself feel a little better about this world, and let's leave it a little better than what we found it. It's just the right thing to do. I want to remind you, too, that there's a special program out there on Fight TV this weekend. It has to do with Steve Mongo McMichael. He's suffering from ALS. And tune into it, Saturday, 12:30 p.m. Moneyformongo.com is the website if you can't watch the program. Saturday at 12:30 p.m., Steve Mongo McMichael, who is part of the 85 Championship Bears and also was part of the WCW program and was one of the four horsemen suffering with ALS. He's not doing very well. They're doing a fundraiser for him. If you can't watch the program on Fight TV, moneyformongo.com. Could be one of those things you do this weekend, whether it's $1, $5, $10, make a donation. Moneyformongo.com and help out Steve Mongo McMichael. And you know what? Some of that money, Steve Mongo McMichael has been giving back to other people that are suffering with ALS. So, you know, do something for someone there as well. That'll do it for me, for Beer City Bruiser, and for the rest of the Darkness Radio team. Have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy your Labor Day, and we will see you right back here for True Crime Tuesday on Tuesday here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.